That Medic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose of education and inspiration in the healthcare field.
Hey everyone, I'm Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
And I'm Daniela, a student at Oxford University.
And this is
That Medic Podcast. Enjoy!
In this podcast, we spoke to Dr. Satish Gopal, Director of the Center for Global Health at the National Cancer Institute. We discussed why students should care about global health, his experience as the only certified medical oncologist in Malawi, a country of 18 million, and how he is helping bridge disparities in the global cancer burden. Today's show is perfect for anyone excited about global health or just intrigued about oncology. But before we get into the episode, I want to tell you briefly about our sponsor, Amboss. Created by a team of dedicated physicians from around the world, Amboss is an interactive library of over 20,000 medical topics, interlinked with a question bank holding more than 5,500 clinical case-based questions. With all the necessary resources in one place, Amboss instantly delivers up-to-date medical knowledge to students, physicians, and faculty globally. Amboss has powerful learning and clinical tools combined into one platform, making studying a breeze and life on the wards easier. With the Amboss library and question bank side by side, students can look up terms instantly when solving questions. Students and physicians around the world use Amboss material to excel in their exams and on the wards, so sign up in minutes at amboss.com. You can try Amboss risk-free with the trial today. Now, onto the episode. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us. So, we normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to go into medicine?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. Yeah, I'd be curious to hear what your other guests have said, but my hope is that everyone says some variation on essentially the same thing, which I think is probably what everyone writes in their medical school application essays as well, which is basically, to help people. I mean, I think that's a little bit trite, but I think that ultimately should be the motivation that most people go into medicine. The other thing that I enjoyed about medicine when I was contemplating a career in medicine and that I've continued to enjoy, over my subsequent career in medicine is the way in which it's a really, I think, potent mix of science and humanities. I think, I studied music as an undergraduate. I was very interested in literature. I also was deeply interested in science. And I think medicine is a very natural place for people with these diverse interests to bring them together because they're so connected to the enterprise.
I couldn't agree more. I study history of science at Harvard, as you know, and that is very much at that intersection of multiple disciplines, and I think it brings an important lens. But you also, of course, have remarkable experience in global health, all of which we'll get to soon. But I'm really curious what initially drew you to global health.
Yeah, so if I went into medicine to help people, then there's a couple of ancillary probably reasons that I went into global health specifically. One of these, I think, is a little bit selfish. That is, I think global health allowed me to help people in a way that made me feel as if I was having as much personal impact as possible. And then the other ancillary reason, I think, is somewhat selfless, I guess I would say. So I think going into global health specifically allowed me to help people who might not have had that help otherwise. And I think both were really important, I think, motivators for me to ultimately pursue a career in global health, which I've remained in for really all of my career in medicine.
Certainly. And I want to go specifically a little bit into your training. You're an oncologist by training, but you did not, in fact, begin your career as an oncologist. You entered practice after completing your internal medicine and pediatrics residency. So I'm very curious to hear what factors led you to specialize in oncology over, for example, any other specialty.
That's a great question. And I must say that I have a somewhat unusual, I think, path to oncology. I really did not see myself as an oncologist until I lived and worked in Africa for the first time. So it is, I am not struck by the irony of the fact that I decided to pursue a career in oncology when I was actually living in a place that had very little cancer-specific resources. And I think that's actually what motivated me. I mean, when I finished residency, I was really interested in global health. I thought it was important to pursue an opportunity that would allow me to live and work abroad to see if that was an interest that I wanted to sustain over the course of a career. When I was living and working in Africa, I was struck by how much cancer there was, how limited resources were to address cancer as an emerging public health problem. And so I was really interested in kind of how one might do that. So I would say my interest in oncology has both a kind of scientific interest and also an equity related interest. So the idea of how cancer care can be so complex in high income countries. And so I think thinking about how one solves often very complex cancer related problems in a low income country, I thought really piqued my scientific interest. And then the other thing to say is that cancer is a disease for which there's been tremendous progress in high income countries, particularly in recent decades, but there remain such disparities globally. So people are doing amazingly well, often in high income countries, but often in low income countries, you know, cancer patients may not have access to therapies that have been proven for many decades. And so I think that equity interest was also a powerful motivating factor for me in pursuing global oncology as a career.
Certainly. And I mean, I want to ask you a question about why students should care about global health and global oncology more specifically.
I think students should care about global health, whether or not they choose to pursue this as a primary career interest. We often say that health is a human right, and I would imagine that many medical students, including many of your classmates, believe that. But I think it's one thing to say it and another thing to mean it. I think the reality is that health is a human right only if it's a human right for all humans everywhere. You know, I think when we exist in a world where how you do after the diagnosis of Burkitt lymphoma or how you do after the diagnosis of breast cancer is so conditioned on what country you were born in or what zip code you live in the US, I think we have to acknowledge that as long as that's true, health really is a privilege and not a human right. I mean, it's important to be pragmatic about this. That isn't to say that everyone can have access to all of the same cutting edge therapies all around the world, but I think there should be some minimum standard that is available to everyone. And without achieving that, I think health is a privilege and not a human right, no matter what we say. For cancer specifically, and for, you know, for those who may be interested in a career in global oncology, you know, what I was attracted to was there's an immense cancer burden globally, and I think we'll talk about that shortly. So there's a real opportunity to address what I think is a looming public health threat worldwide. And I think the efforts to meaningfully address this are still quite nascent. So if you compare to HIV, where, you know, there's been a decades-long international coalition that have really made HIV treatment available to patients on a global scale, those efforts are really don't have the scale maturity for cancer that they do for infectious diseases. And so I think, you know, being able to contribute to that larger effort at an early stage, I think was really attractive for me.
There seems to be a real opportunity to make an important difference. And I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier in that answer. For students who don't pursue global health as their primary career interest, that they should still care about global health. And I was wondering if someone's not, for example, moving to Africa and working there and pursuing global health full time, what are their opportunities to still contribute to important narratives and fighting the cancer burden that someone can do?
I think it's possible to have a global perspective, even if you're not engaging directly in global health related work. I think, you know, people who are entering medicine now, no matter what discipline they go into, no matter what specific disease area they study, I think it is important to acknowledge that that problem likely afflicts people all around the world. And I think, again, this doesn't require necessarily everyone to move to a foreign country, but I think whatever their career trajectory ends up looking like, I think that awareness that health is a human right, that many of the problems that we talk about and study in the United States affect people all around the world, I think that larger awareness is valuable, I think, even if people are not directly engaging in the work themselves, because inevitably they will be in positions of power or being reviewing grant applications or reviewing manuscripts or making funding decisions. And so I think bringing that larger awareness to those decisions, I think, is important.
Mm-hmm. The awareness and the perspective, you're right, it's incredibly important. And I want to go back to your career now. You led the cancer program for UNC Project Malawi. We're coming to the National Cancer Institute, the NCI. For our listeners, this cancer program was a research and care collaboration between the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the Malawi Ministry of Health. So could you tell me more about the program and how you came to lead it?
Well, you described it really well. I mean, as you said, it's a decades-long clinical research collaboration between the University of North Carolina and the Malawi Ministry of Health. There are many similar academic programs, I think, with a very similar trajectory. So I think you can find examples of these across United States universities, you know, European universities, often where they have found an institutional partner in a specific context and have really made investments over time that have allowed growth of a clinical research program. historically, I think almost all of these have had an HIV or an infectious disease focus. And I think what you see with all of them now is that they are now pivoting to other health areas, including cancer. You know, I think there's been remarkable progress for many infectious diseases, including HIV. There's been important epidemiologic transitions in many low and middle income countries, such that they're now suffering from heart disease and cancer and strokes and hypertension and motor vehicle accidents, you know, problems that were historically not thought of as being major public health problems in low and middle income countries. And as a result, I think many of these academic partnerships are now pivoting to study important topics of public health concern in the environments in which they're working. And a lot of that is driven by their in-country partners. You know, I think the Malawi Ministry of Health wanted our collaboration and our program to address these emerging public health threats. And I think we felt it was our responsibility to do that. So I came to lead the cancer part of our portfolio, as you alluded to, and I think that was largely by default. I mean, I don't think it was because I had any exceptional aptitude in this area. I think when you're the only medical oncologist in a country, you kind of end up leading the cancer research program, whether you like it or not. And I think at the time that I moved to Malawi in 2012 with my family, again, we had a fairly established program that was working largely in HIV. There was some limited interest in cancer, but there was really no structured way of diagnosing, treating, following patients. There was no real systematic and rigorous data collection, nor application of current approaches and methods in cancer research to the population in Malawi. And that includes things like genomics, you know, patient-reported outcomes, all of these things that we now take for granted in the cancer research enterprise in the United States were really not being brought to bear, you know, patient experiences in Malawi. And we thought it was important to engage in some of that work. That's the work that I led before coming to the NCI.
Mm-hmm. And something you alluded to, and one of the most eye-catching details about your work, is that you are the only certified medical oncologist in Malawi, which is a country of 18 million people. What was that experience like? What were some of the challenges, and what was most rewarding about it?
It was very humbling. I think that is true of oncology in general, but then I think it gets compounded when you're working in a setting like Malawi or perhaps another low and middle income country. And it's humbling in a couple of different ways. I think first, inevitably, as oncologists, we are sometimes not able to help patients as much as we would like, right? They're run out of therapeutic options, or even in the United States, you have patients who rapidly progress through clinical trials, and then ultimately, you know, you don't really have anything meaningful to offer them. That's compounded in a place like Malawi by the lack of availability of a lot of proven therapies, where there's always this part of you in the back of your mind that's thinking, I know if I had access to this agent that was approved in the US several years ago, that this patient would likely do very well. So I think it's very humbling just in terms of your own efficacy in serving your patients. I mean, the other part of being an oncologist that I would say is humbling, and I think this is true in the United States and perhaps in some ways compounded in Malawi or another low and middle income country, is that, you know, you're humbled by not always being able to do as much for patients as you would like. You're also humbled by kind of the extraordinary lengths that patients go through to try to overcome a cancer diagnosis. You know, it's really just an immense struggle that's borne by patients and their families. And that's very true in the United States. You know, when you have patients who undergo bone marrow transplant or, you know, all of these fairly intense and sophisticated therapies to try to survive their cancer, it's really a heroic effort that's required. In Malawi, you know, we saw patients who came from all over the country. So these are often patients that are living in rural villages, you know, jumping on the back of a truck that happens to be passing by on the highway next to their village to come to their appointment, and doing that repeatedly, you know, week after week to get the care that they feel they deserve. And I think I often thought to myself in Malawi, you know, I'm not certain that I would make this effort if it were me. And so, you know, I think both in the United States and in Malawi, the other really humbling part of being an oncologist is just seeing what patients and their families are willing to go through to try to survive a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, it makes you think, and very, very inspiring. And something that your story brings out, of course, is that there's obviously a problem of too few medical specialists in low and middle income countries. And that manifests itself in inadequate care for all sorts of chronic diseases, like cancer, but also like heart disease and like obesity. So I'm very curious to talk to you about what steps you think are needed to create a pipeline of specialists in low and middle income countries so that we go beyond awareness and establish a more sustainable enterprise in these countries.
I think the key word in your question is really pipeline, right? Because you know, you as an aspiring medical student, I mean, you're aware, you're already looking forward and kind of seeing your entire career trajectory, the shape that you would like that to have, and have a, you know, have some level of confidence that there will be opportunities for you at every step along that way, right? So that, I mean, that's really what's needed. And I think we were beginning to do a lot of this in Malawi, is identifying young investigators who are interested in cancer research careers, providing them with support, you know, helping mentor them to do their own research, allowing them to compete for their own funding while maintaining their clinical responsibilities. So it's really that pipeline approach that is necessary to allow people to enter the field and then sustain them over a period of time. The other thing that's important, elements of that pipeline are, you know, strong mentorship and then developing really contextually appropriate career models, right? So being a cancer researcher in Malawi probably doesn't look exactly like it looks like in the United States. You're inevitably going to have more clinical and programmatic responsibilities just because of the setting. And so trying to balance that, but still create space to develop a career, trying to ask and answer questions that are important to you and your patients, that really requires a contextually appropriate model. And again, I think we made a lot of progress in starting to build that pipeline and develop those models in Malawi. And a lot of that is continuing on now, even after I've left, which is the really exciting part.
Yeah. So on that note, what are you most proud about during your time there? And how long were you in Malawi for?
So I lived in Malawi for 7 years. And I think the continued sustained excellence of the program, even after I have left, including this thriving of these really talented young investigators, both from the US and Malawi, who are working together on problems, cancer-related problems in Malawi. You know, I think that we probably couldn't have anticipated that that would take hold in quite the way that it has, and that's been tremendously rewarding to see.
And before we get back to the episode, a brief word from our sponsors.
Amboss is a medical knowledge platform built on three fundamental elements. At the core, a comprehensive medical library helps students learn the facts and the nuances of medicine. Also central is the QBank. By using these tools, students unlock the third element, personalized analytics, which helps students make smart studying decisions. Three essential tools of learning, all in one place. It's no surprise Amboss has become one of the most popular resources for students and schools worldwide. Ready to take a closer look? Sign up for a free trial today at amboss.com.
Now, back to the episode.
And as we've alluded to a little bit earlier in the podcast, you're now the director of the Center for Global Health at the NCI. So for our students at home, what exactly is the NCI and what are your responsibilities as director of the Center for Global Health?
So as someone who works at the NCI, I of course can't imagine that anyone doesn't know what the NCI is, but thank you for calling that out. The NCI is the National Cancer Institute, which is the largest funder of cancer research in the world. The institute was established in 1937 and was established really in its current form by the National Cancer Act of 1971. And the reality is the NCI has actually been globally engaged since its establishment, you know, in 1937. However, 10 years ago in 2011, it was felt that there was a need for a dedicated Center for Global Health, that there was enough activity, enough need, enough opportunity related to global cancer research and control, that this really needed to be concentrated and coordinated in a dedicated center at the NCI. And that's when the Center for Global Health was established. And I think a lot has really changed in the last 10 years. In 2011, really the focus was on establishing a center and starting to integrate cancer into the broader global health conversation, because I think it wasn't getting the attention always that it deserved. I think in 2021, we're in a very different place. I think we're now no longer establishing a center. We're really trying to evolve a center for the future. And instead of just integrating cancer into global health, I think we're really now trying to prioritize cancer and global health. It's an immense problem and really requires the smartest people to kind of be thinking about it in a serious way.
I want to pull out a thread that we've been discussing a bit throughout the interview about the prioritization of cancer and how it hasn't traditionally been a priority around the world and in low and middle income countries. You brought up the example of HIV, which has received, on the other hand, a lot of attention and prioritization. And I was curious, why do you think cancer hasn't risen to the same level of prominence as HIV and other chronic diseases?
Historically, cancer has been thought of as a disease of high-income countries. And I think that is clearly not true any longer. But I think that thinking is still hard to overcome. The WHO estimates that 1 in 6 deaths currently is due to cancer worldwide. And the burden is increasing, and particularly the burden that's borne by low- and middle-income countries is increasing. So between 2020 and 2040, the number of cancer deaths worldwide will go from 10 million to 16 million, and 69% of cancer deaths will be in low- and middle-income countries in 2040. That being said, this is a slow-burning fire, right? This is a fire that is slowly enlarging, as opposed to HIV in the 1980s, which came on, you know, very quickly, or COVID more recently, right? These are rapidly enlarging fires. And just as a matter of urgency, I think they tend to attract a lot of attention in a way that cancer burden, which is slowly increasing worldwide year after year, decade after decade, it's hard to generate the sense of urgency around a slowly developing problem that there is around a quickly developing problem, even though the toll in terms of, you know, the economic toll, the cost in human lives, may be even larger as it is for cancer than it may be for other diseases. So I think we have a hard time sometimes thinking long term and thinking about things that are not right in front of us. And I think in some ways cancer has suffered from that. In addition to this, you know, historical anachronism of thinking about cancer as largely being a disease in high income countries.
And I wanted to go back to the center and how the center is bridging these disparities in the global cancer burden. Can you share some of the work to that end?
Sure. The one thing I will point out is I think global health and health disparities, I think of these as somewhat distinct fields. So there's a lot of scientific and philosophical overlap between these two fields. And we're actually thinking a lot about how to bring these fields together in a way that is impactful. But I do think global health and health disparities historically have been somewhat distinct. So, you know, our work at the Center for Global Health is really concentrated in 4 primary areas. So one is research. So we're interested in research, supporting and conducting research specifically that addresses key scientific issues in global cancer control or leverages unique opportunities that come from global collaboration. We're very interested in training. So you and I just spoke about this, but supporting global cancer research training that really enables equitable and impactful global collaboration is important to us. We have activities that are focused on dissemination. So how can we promote the integration of current scientific knowledge into global cancer control policies and practice? And then finally, partnerships, which is very important for the NCI Center for Global Health and has been since we were first founded. I mean, the reality is global cancer is an enormous problem and really beyond the ability of the NCI to address on its own. So it's critical that we have partnerships with other international, governmental, non-governmental entities. And typically in the global cancer research and control space, we play a representational role to help facilitate interactions between NCI and these other critical partners. We actually wrote an editorial about this recently in JAMA. Ned Sharpless, the NCI director, and I, we also have a newly articulated strategic plan, which is publicly available on our website. And if people are interested, they can find a lot more information about specific programs that fall under each of these goal areas that are either currently active or in development.
Terrific. And the notion of health equity, as we've spoken about a little bit today, has gained tremendous attention over the past year, but it sometimes feels that these discussions don't really go beyond the U.S. context. And this seems to be most apparent with the COVID-19 vaccine distribution, where low- and middle-income countries have largely been excluded, but a lot of attention is on equity in the U.S., which is, of course, a very important and pressing problem as well. But my question for you is, what do you think can be done to add or even shift the focus of health equity to more global contexts?
So one is something we already spoke about. I think it is incumbent on us to truly embrace health as a human right rather than a privilege. I think it's not right to just say health is a human right and then not treat it as such. I think we have to be pragmatic about that still. Again, the idea that bone marrow transplantation will be imminently available to patients in Malawi is not correct, but patients should not die for lack of access to generic chemotherapy drugs that have been in place since the 1950s and 1960s. So there has to be a minimum standard that is available to patients all around the world. And that, to me, is really what embracing health as a human right would mean, rather than the privilege that I think characterizes health quite frankly, even today. I guess the other thing I would say is I think people should approach global health with a bit more humility and inclusiveness. And I think that's something that we're trying to do now at the NCI. I mean, we're really trying to embrace this moment and think about what global health should look like going forward. I think there are tremendous opportunities to learn from the way that cancer care is being done around the world. You know, how can you make cancer care available to some of the most vulnerable patients who may be the hardest to reach in the world? I mean, those lessons will be valuable for even increasing access for underrepresented communities in the United States. So, you know, I think the really taking the opportunity to learn from international partners and to include cancer patients all around the world in the cancer research enterprise. That is, populations that have not historically had opportunities to participate in cancer research and benefit from cancer research should have those opportunities. And I think the discipline will be stronger as a result of that. And I think that's a lot of where our attention is at the Center for Global Health currently.
Certainly. The efforts don't have to be mutually exclusive. They are built on certain synergy. And I think that nearly wraps up the episode. But before we go, could I ask you for 3 pieces of advice for students interested in careers in global health?
Sure. That's a great question. I'm not sure how specific my advice is to global oncology. I think this is actually advice that's applicable to any field. In thinking about this, I mean, the first thing I would say is immerse yourself in whatever discipline you're interested in. So if you're interested in global health, I think you need to immerse yourself in global health and not the idea of global health, right? So that means you have to actually go and live in a place and work there and learn from collaborators and mentors on the ground. So I think immersion is important. The second related piece of advice is to find mentors who really embody the type of career that you seek for yourself. And again, I think that is not global health specific, but I think strong global health mentorship can be difficult to find, especially in a new area like cancer. And so I would encourage people to seek out people who can provide that sort of mentorship. And then I think you asked for 3. So the last one, if you'll indulge me, I'll do a 2-part because they're related. First is understand that challenges are inevitable. These can usually be overcome and are usually not as large as they might seem. And I think the second part of that and the related aspect of that is that you should really savor small victories, which are usually not as small as they seem. You know, for me, doing cancer-related work in Malawi, you know, often we were doing relatively small studies of 40, 50, 60 patients. And the thing I always still try to remember, even now at the NCI, is that, you know, every data point in those papers often reflects a person who's alive because we happen to be in a particular place at a particular time and offered them something that they wouldn't have had access to otherwise. You know, that's a small victory in some respects and a very large victory in other respects. So.
What a terrific way to end. Thank you so much, Dr. Goval, for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.